This episode is brought to you by CEP Compression Australia. CEP Compression brings the user more energy, greater endurance, and enhanced performance during activities. For a discount at CEP, use the following code online, local legends in running. Welcome to the Local Legends in Running podcast, where you hear the stories of local legends in the Australian running community that you've simply always wanted to hear. Today in season 3, episode 6, I sit down to talk with my father, Mark Jones. Dad, now in his 60s, has been an avid runner from a very young age. He excelled at the school level in the 400 to 1500 meter events and then transitioned to the half marathon and marathon post having children. Additionally, he thoroughly enjoyed being involved in his son's running, frequently attending their races and starting a tradition where he'd take them individually to Sydney for City to Surf at the age of 14. It was a pleasure sitting down, listening to his stories again, or for the very first time, about Dad's experiences from years ago to this very day. Yeah, so right now, are you running it through the computer?
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good, actually.
Okay, so that's better than the AirPods.
I think it is. Yeah. Which is ironic, people wear them a lot, don't they, for meetings and things?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, welcome officially, Mark Jones, the Local Legends in Running podcast, aka Dad. How are you?
Good, mate, and thanks for having me on.
No problem. Say it's a Tuesday, 9th of April. It's 1:11 on the clock. School holidays for me as a teacher. How has your day looked? You've been out with the Watts Athletics Group this morning?
Yeah, actually, had a very short session, so it let me return to some speeds that I was running some years ago, which was fun. Just a lot shorter than I was doing in those days. But Shiloh prepares really fantastic sessions, to be honest. Really interesting and fun.
Yeah, and Shiloh Watts has been on the podcast and Watts named after her. But back to you anyway, Dad, looking forward very much to this. What a unique situation, a podcaster to have his own father on an episode. And for a number of reasons. Well, number one, you're my dad. But two, probably a big reason why I run is because of you. And looking forward to hearing about your experience back in the 70s, 80s, even the 90s, and even the last 2 years too, with that unfortunate diagnosis of mesothelioma as well, which we'll talk about at the back end probably of the episode.
Yeah, well, when you invited me, I sort of thought of what we might end up talking about, and I came to the realization I've had four separate and very different running lives.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to sort of talk through the challenges and joys and the different nature of different eras of running in Brisbane. So I took up running 53 years ago. I'm talking competitive club distance running. So I've been around a long time and seen a lot of changes.
Yeah. And you and I just on the weekend too are part of the Brisbane Roadrunners event, not a championship event, which they do call about once every month or so, but a 15K for you, 20K for me. I think you planned 20K, but you pulled out halfway through. So what happened there?
I got a bit soft in the rain, I think. Actually, for your listeners, the truth is I was planning to go out at 5 minute K pace. And for Oliver, the difference between 5 minute Ks and sort of 4:55 Ks is nothing. But for me, it did make a difference.
Yes.
So I was pretty shot at 12K and battled through to 15 holding pace. We ran very evenly, mate, actually, which is always a joy. I love running dead evenly.
I was definitely happy with that. About 5 to 7 seconds range from the slowest to the quickest K. Yeah. But yeah, like you alluded to, Dad, we're going to cover your experience back through those decades, but also not just for you, but how you know, different training methods were like back then, how the runners, the elite runners were training, and your memories of that, even things like footwear or nutrition and how that's varied from today to back then. So definitely looking forward to delving into that. I want to sort of start to learn about you, and not just as a dad to me, but as a person. So you happen to talk about your work, because it's almost about, I was thinking this morning about your retirement from architecture was about almost 10 years ago, wasn't it?
That's correct. So I had a long career in architectural practice, and I gave it away in 2015 to head overseas to do some study. And since 2020, I've been an academic teaching architecture at UQ. Very nice lifestyle, very satisfying. But I guess for my whole adult life, I've had these three streams, really. Family's number one. And a bit of a close tussle as to what's number two between my sport and my work. I think all of it might be the same. As to, you know, what percentage of my brain's devoted to running is probably 60-40 running work, to be honest. It's always been a serious priority to me. And, you know, sometimes I think, oh, Jonesy, what, you know, you're taking yourself too seriously. You're pretty modest runner, but it's important to me, and it's seen me through a lot of good times and a lot of bad times.
Yeah, for sure. And living wise, you moved to West End just over that time ago, I think, over 10 years ago on Riverside Drive there on the river. Now, definitely a mecca in a way for running. How's your experience been living close by to that that environment?
Well, it's great just hopping out. I live in a set of apartments called Coco next to the Grammar Rowing Sheds, and yeah, just straight out onto Riverside Drive and away you go, cycling or running. If the river was clean, I'd be able to throw swimming in there too. But no, it's a great spot, and my wife is in the local rowing club, so convenient for her. No, it's a good spot. And of course, whenever we go out onto the road here, there's dozens and dozens of runners. It's a bit of a runner's mecca, like you say.
Absolutely. Hey, back to work, but more so post-work. Since that retirement of you as a director in architecture as a career, just talk to us about what you did, because you moved away to Oxford to study and then to now work at the University of Queensland, another actually running mecca, as we just spoke about.
Yeah, well, I guess I'd like to work through those four running lives. My running life number three was my period in England. And it's a very different, really interesting running environment compared to Australia, or certainly Brisbane. So, yeah, I'll come to that when we get to that running life, if that's okay. But it was a real shot in the arm for me and for my running, which I'll explain when we come to it. But yeah, it was good. It was good to get out of the comfort zone initially, but then it became the comfort zone, to be honest. So I really found my tribe over there.
Definitely. Last one about you, and that is, any hobbies outside of running now? Of course, you're working there at the university, but you're a grandparent now, I think, to, what is it, up to 8, 9 grandkids? What's the number?
Well, yeah, 9 plus some twins on the way, mate. So to the listeners that don't know, I've got 6 adult sons, 6 magnificent sons. Oliver's the only serious runner. Reese is a pretty damn good sub-20-minute 5K guy too, excuse me. But, yeah, they've all produced a couple of grandkids each, basically, and it's prolific. So, look, I've been contemplating full retirement, and I'm a bit scared of it because I don't have any other hobbies. And with running, you know, you can get up, go for a run, have breakfast, and it's still 10 hours till dinner, you know, so I'm not sure how I'm going to fill that time yet. Yeah, I don't have a train set or play guitar or anything, so I'm going to have to find something.
For sure. Hey, let's get to these running PBs. We've set the scene, I guess, about you, Dad, a biography of you personally, but how about running? Because my memory of you is that you were quite handy on the track. So we're talking even as low as 400 meters, but definitely 800 and a bit of 1500. And then, yeah, that sort of extra or next life came in where you, when you started to become a dad, and then you came back to the half marathon and marathon distance later on. So if we started back at the 400 and 800, do you recall the times that you were running back then?
Yeah, well, look, I recall a hell of a lot, actually. So just to go back a big step, my dad was pretty fast. So when I was 7 or 8, I was in Cubs, and we had a scout group picnic at that park at Fernie Grove opposite the station. And there was probably all sorts of novelty races, but there was a father's race, right? And it was probably over about 50 metres, I guess. But my father won by 20 metres, if it was 50 metres. I was astounded that a human being could run that fast. I was so, so proud and just stunned. And I thought, wow, I want to be like that. And many years later, I found out that he was a 9.9 second runner for 100 yards, not meters, yards, which equals 10.9 or 11 for 100 meters, you know, on a ratty grass track with no gym training or anything in his late teens. So it's pretty quick. So presumably I've got some fast twitch fibers, and then presumably so have you.
Not really.
Your mum was a pretty nippy top class tennis player, so there must be some fast twitch in there for you, mate. Yeah, you've never shown it.
No, definitely not as low as 400. But give us an idea of the times though, Ben.
Yeah, sure. So the year I was 18, in those days, the junior age group was under 19. Soon after, it changed to under 20 as a global standard. But as an 18-year-old, my season then was 12.1 for 100, 23.9 for 200, 52.6 for 400, and 155.4 for 800, and 359.1 for 1500. I didn't have a great top speed, 12.1, 23.9 for an 800 runner. In retrospect, maybe I should have pushed out a little bit further in most distances, but I just loved the 800. The 800, it's the shortest distance that's not in lanes. The first 100 metres is in lanes. In fact, for 1 year, 1975, when I was in grade 11, they changed that to be the first 300 in lanes, which was interesting. And it was an easier race then, but they reverted. And yeah, it's probably the only really violent race, because you've got to get good position down that first back straight, or you can't win, basically, unless you're with vastly inferior runners. It's a hugely tactical, exciting, very, very exciting race. You know, if you make a mistake in a 1500, you can sort of slip out of the back of the pack if you're boxed and get round to the front again. 400 is just a matter of experience and knowing how fast you should go for the first 150, how fast for the 150, and how much you can hang on for that last 100, you know? Simple. But in 800, there's so much happening so quickly. I just loved it. So I took up 800s in grade 7. So at the time I saw my dad do that run in the school sports, grade 2, I remember being second last out of all the grade 2 boys. I was a gangly, uncoordinated guy. But something happened through the years. I walked to school up a massive hill. It was 1 mile, 1.5 Ks, I guess, every day from grade 1 to 7. It's not the sort of thing that happens so much now. So there's a bit of fitness there. And we were all rugby league maniacs at primary school. So as soon as the bell went, we were down on the oval playing rugby league for the whole lunch hour, you know. So there's probably a fair bit of fitness and coordination coming through. And then there was nothing longer than 100 metres through grades 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But then grade 6, they introduced a 200, which we all thought was a middle distance event, you know. And they put all the grade 6s on the start line. It's probably about 35 of us, and just, you know, ready, set, go. And I remember I came about fourth or fifth, and I started to think, you know, something's happening here. Maybe I can do okay at this. And then the following year, grade seven, which in those days was the final year of high school, they brought in an 800. And there was a school hero called Cameron Bell who'd won everything, 100, 200, discus, long jump, the lot, you know. So it was assumed he'd win the 800 as well, which was the last event. And meanwhile, I was starting to notice that girls weren't such horrible things after all. And I fell in love with this girl called Kim. And I got it into my head that if I led the first lap, it was a three-lap race. If I led the first lap of the 800, Kim would fall in love with me. Anyway, so there's probably 20 on the start line, and I just bolted. And I was leading after one lap. And you remember what primary school sports like. The kids go nuts.
Yeah.
So I was in the red house, and Cameron Bell was in the blue house. So all the blue house and red house kids are going nuts. You remember that in your school sports day?
Yeah.
It's just crazy. So I've got, you know, a body full of adrenaline from all these kids cheering and from imagining this girl with love hearts popping out of her eyes. And so I pushed on hard for another, the second of three laps. But before I get to that, I turned around after one lap and Cameron Bell was sort of 2 meters behind me. And then there was a huge gap to third. And when I think back, that moment sort of defined the rest of my life, you know. That was the moment I realized that I could actually do something better than average. And so, yeah, I pushed on hard around the second lap, turned around after two laps. Cameron Bell was maybe 5 meters behind me, blowing like a steam train, half a lap back to third. And so, yeah, he came close to catching me, but he didn't. And then in those days, you went to zones. In your day, there was a regional layer. Mm. In those days, went to zones and then zones to state. So at the zones, there's 13 schools. It was held at Mitchie High School. And I came second there. So I qualified for the state championships. I think I ran 2:30. And I got knocked out in the heat of the state championships. But my parents had never had any awareness that I had any aptitude at any sport, because I was pretty bad at all sports, to be honest. Not like, just for the listeners, Oliver was good at everything. Lawn bowls, netball, badminton, everything.
Jack of all trades, master of none.
I wasn't like that. But anyway, so my parents thought, and I heard them sort of speaking when they didn't know I was listening, saying, if he's gone this well with no training, we should get him into a running club. And my father had been in Maine Harriers back in his teens, but that was a pretty inconvenient spot. So they got me into a club called Kelvin Grove that trained at there was an oval opposite West Mitchie's club, behind the Gaythorne RSL, believe it or not. There was a 400-metre track. And, yeah, we used to train there. And I just loved it and started to improve from there across a number of years. So my running life, number one, goes across the whole 70s, actually. And the interesting thing was in the school, through the school athletic system, I'd generally, well, the school sports, I generally win 400, 800, 1500 cross country each year, and then go to zones come second or third in most of those. Oh, sorry, not cross country, second or third in 400, 800, 1500, and then go to the states and get eliminated in the heats. But in the club system, which obviously was much weaker, I guess it still is, I'd make the final and get a medal most years. And my times were sort of, I remember I ran 2:10 in grade 10 and 2:04 in grade 11. But the interesting one was grade, sorry, I'm not leaving any room for your questions here, mate, but you've got me on
this is easy.
grade 12, There was a meet called the Schoolboys Meet. Now, I think it might have been resurrected recently, but the Schoolboys Meet then was all the GPS schools, all the Catholic schools, all the private schools, all the state schools could send their runners to the schoolboys. And it was very popular with all the coaches at the private schools because it was a bit of a test for how they were going before the main Jeeps meet or the main AIC meet or whatever. And it was bloody great for the stronger state school runners because we could test ourselves against the, the cream. So grade 12, a coach came to my school called Harvey Cheatham, and much like you, mate, he would run with us, and he was just a really inspiring guy. So I think your students are very lucky. Well, I know your students are very lucky having you run with them, because it's really inspiring for youngsters to have that and see that. Anyway, he pushed me pretty hard. And I'd had years of training pretty hard for a youngster. My mum talks about picking me up and me, you know, vomiting on the footpath as a 13, wow. 14, 15-year-old. So I'd sort of learned to run pretty hard. But the schoolboys championships, I broke 2 minutes. And that was the first time, actually, that I'd run on a tartan track. So they built CUSAC, get ready for the Commonwealth Games. And I was running 2:01, 2 minutes and half a second or whatever a few times. But I went to that track and did 1:59.4, and I was over the moon, you know. That was considered a pretty good time for a schoolboy then. And I qualified for the final. I think I came fifth. So, you know, from sort of sparking an interest as a seven-year-old who couldn't run, and 10 years later, as a 17-year-old at school, I was fifth in the state, and quite genuinely, I think, I was pretty pleased with myself. So that Kelvin Grove Club was fairly small and not well serviced. So I moved to another club called Nunda. And coincidentally, some years later, those two clubs merged to form a club called Athletics North. I'm not sure if they're still around or not. But Nunda was a very strong distance club, not so much in 800 metres, but they had a good coach and lots of good runners. There was a guy called Gary Briggs who ran for Australia over steeplechase, still in the top 20 times for an Australian. Another guy called Mike Pullinger, who was a multiple Queensland rep and, in fact, the inaugural winner of the Gold Coast Half. And a lot of other guys that run for Queensland. So I, was inspired really by their training. It was damn hard training at Banyo High School. Now,
Close to my house now. And what was the running scene like back then, Dad? Like, as a runner, both in school but also outside, what was the take or perception of a runner? Was it someone who would draw crowds of mates or ladies or vice versa, whatever you're into?
Well, the what I'm going to say, you and most listeners might not believe this, but mm-hmm. I ran across the whole 1970s living at Everton Park, which was sort of an outer suburb. I probably, you know, I trained at a lot of other places like Banyo, but I probably averaged across those 10 years, 3 runs a week. Around the streets of Everton Park, Stafford, Bunyaville, Mitchelton. I never saw another runner. I never, in all those years.
Wondering where you're going with that. Yeah.
It just wasn't a thing.
There's the answer.
I think part of it is my parents' generation did not exercise. It just wasn't even a part of their mentality. Whereas now, you know, there's a good percentage, at least of people of a, you know, reasonable socioeconomic status that exercises normal in tier 40s, 50s, 60s and beyond. So that wasn't there. People beyond school, they just gave up sport in those days. So that was pretty interesting. The training, it was a lot of reps, not too different to these days. I'll talk about... can I just move on without you asking a question, or do you want to ask something?
Go ahead, you're on a roll.
Okay, well, the coach that I had at Nunda initially was a bit of a grumpy bum, and he had a falling out with a couple of the runners, and so we were left without a coach. Phil Hungerford, who you probably know,
yeah, came along. Owned the Nike store over at Stafford, yep. Wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The run-in. He helped out. Mike Pullinger, who I mentioned, helped out a bit. But I was floundering, and I met a guy in the club called Chris Hurl, who's probably 10 years older than me. And I'd listened to him at club barbecues or whatever, and I could tell he knew a lot about running. And so I wrote to him, and in those days, no email or anything. So I wrote him a letter with a stamp, the whole bit, saying, would you coach me? I know how to run hard, I remember telling him. I want to do a lot better than I've been doing. And he took a while to respond, but he responded. And that's where I really improved. So that was October 1977, my first year out of school. I'd done the cross-country season. So winter cross-country. That's the other thing with the running in the 70s. There was no fun runs. There was no marathons. There was actually a state marathon championship each year, but there's about 60 runners, 70 runners maybe. There was no, Gold Coast or it just didn't exist in Australia. So, the guys that did well in marathoning in those years, Derek Clayton and people like that, that they just would have been out by themselves with, goodness knows how they got to the heights they got.
Oh, for sure. And then what about after high school, though, in those handful of years before meeting now my mother? And in that time where you're both studying, socializing, and then training, how much were you sort of pushing the running and training specifically to race at that time of your life?
Yeah. So when Chris took me on, I've got his very first training schedule for me here. So this is from October to November 77. 5 miles, which is 8K every morning, every weekday morning, Monday to Friday. And he's got in here brackets, plus chin-ups and sit-ups.
There's the key then
Monday evening, this is extraordinary, actually, and I remember these. 2 miles warm-up, which is 8 laps of the track. This is Bagneau, mate.
Yep.
6 separate 3/4 miles. So that's 1200s with 10 minutes break.
10 minutes.
10 minutes break and then a mile warm down. So we were there for an hour and a half.
Jeez.
It's a pretty damn good commitment by him, but obviously also by me. And it was just me by myself at first till word got round that Chris was taking this on and people started rolling in. But I remember, and I've got the record of the session, so I would run those 6 at 255 kilometre pace. Obviously a very big, very big rest where I'd just jog very slowly, but pretty quick. But that was big, big volume for a sprinter, an 800 true runner. So that was Monday. Oh, and then later in the season, had the same session, but only 4 of them. And I was doing 245 pace as I was sharpening up for that same session. Tuesday, 10K course of Bunnyville carrying weights. So Bunnyville's very
and very it's a
run hard up the hills. So I was carrying, I think it was a 2 kilogram dumbbell in each hand. It might have been 1.5. It sounds tiny, but I tell you, by the end, and you're pumping your arms really hard up the hills, that really hardened me up. And I had to do that Monday and Thursday.
And literally the same running arms, keeping the running form with the weights.
Yeah. I think it's probably bad for you, to be honest. I think it's probably a really bad idea. I wouldn't recommend it because putting too much load on your Achilles and everything. But anyway, mentally, it really hardened me up. You're in a race tussling with someone down the back straight of a 1500 or something, and you're thinking, I've done that, and this guy has not done that.
So I'm going to beat Hunyerville, mate. Wait.
Wednesday, 6 miles over Gulf Links at 6 minute mile pace. What's that about? I don't know what that is. And then a sprint every 400 yards, sprint of 50 yards. Sorry about all this. This was just as Australia went metric.
Yards, so
Thursday was at Bunnyville again. Friday, 3 miles easy. Saturday was race. And then Sunday, 10 miles across hills. So that was sort of a big volume early in the season and just kept sharpening me up all season. And then it came to the state championships, which I won. So I was the state junior, which was under 19 champion.
You're about to ask your age. Yeah, 19.
Yeah, no, I was under 19. I was 18. I won that, and I went under 4 minutes for 1500, which got me a bronze medal in the 1500. Two went through to the state, so I didn't qualify for the 15, but I qualified for the nationals in the 800, and I had a pretty good heat, 156. I led the whole way. Actually, we knew. Chris and I knew that I wasn't fast, so the way to qualify was just to make it solid so the sprinters wouldn't be able to jump me. So I led the whole way, 156.2, and then I stuffed up the final, unfortunately. I think I could have got down into the 153s, but could have snipped, doesn't mean anything. And that was that. And then he kept me on for another season. And I got to, I decided actually at the start of the season, if I could get down to 350 for a 1500, I'd give away my studies for a while and see what I could do with my running. But in those days, at age 20, you used to sort of feel a bit of an obligation to earn your keep in your family. And I didn't really want to live off my parents for much longer.
No. What were the options though? Where could you go, or who could you be coached by?
I would have found a coach locally. It never occurred to me to try to go to American University or something, but that would have been extraordinary if I could have done that.
Yeah, still a thing back then?
Yeah, it wasn't really, I didn't know of anyone who did that. But I got down to 355.9 for 1500, which is pretty good. But really, it's such a long way from national representation that it wasn't worth giving up my budding career and imposing on my parents for a second rate runner. So I packed it in, and it must be very hard for elite sportsmen to give up their sport, because someone at my modest level giving up sport, I suffered for quite a long time missing it, actually.
Oh yeah, can't imagine. Yeah. And that's that week of yours in training wise, in terms of how far, what was your weekly mileage? And the other question too is, you spoke about the hills out at Bunyaville. Did you track the elevation at all? Sort of done on your watch now on Strava and Garmin and things like that.
I'll tell you what, mate, I would love to have a heat map. I would love to have a heat map of my youth, my running in my youth. It would be so intense. We did a lot of hills, and we did a lot of training out at Burpengary through the pine forests. It was extraordinary.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And on soft
still
pine
there.
Needles. Yeah.
Off the highway.
Because those days, we didn't have any, there was zero cushioning in the shoes. It was basically sort of, I guess, 5 millimeter thick sort of rubber. In a way, it was good. It gave you a really good feel for the whatever you were running on. But there's no cushioning and no spring.
Yeah, the thing too is, the roads. The roads through the 70s in Brisbane, how much of it was asphalt versus dirt though? Because that would have allowed you at least to use those kind of shoes. Yeah. I couldn't imagine those on the roads.
Yeah, so my 5 mile runs in the mornings there, I'd go alternately, went out to the top of Camellia Avenue, beyond Pullen Road, turn left and out Plux Road to Bunya Road. And by the time I got to the top of Camellia Avenue, it was dirt track. Yep. That's how far out of town I was.
Yeah.
and the other way, I went out Old Northern Road and into Bunnyville a little bit. And, yeah, as soon as you got to the end of Queens Road, for anyone who knows all this, it was dirt.
I do.
So it was delightful, actually. It was forest.
Yeah.
Weekly mileage. I remember running 2,500 miles 1 year. What's that? 4,000 Ks. That'd be max. So Chris trained me. It was a Lydiard system that Peter Snell and so on had used, where they train like a marathoner, I guess. No, not like a marathoner, like a 10K half marathoner through winter. and sharpen up through the summer. So yeah, I competed in cross countries. The best I got was at Nudgee College, actually, in a Queensland state championship cross country. I ran 42.20 for 12K, and got 20th or 19th, actually. So you know, I was an okay second tier runner, and I was a middle runner in my club, which was full of state champions and things. But it was great. Our Sunday runs were pretty damn solid. I was sort of hanging on the back all the time. The other guys were sort of wondering what an 800 runner was doing there, I guess. But by the time I'd get to the season, I'd be have a pretty deep foundation. In a way, I wish I'd realised that I was too slow for an 800, and perhaps 1500 5K might have been better. I did an 8:49 3K.
That was my next question, a 3 and a 5.
Yeah, so 8:49 3K. I never did a 5K. That 3K converts to a 15:10, but I don't think I would have done a 15:10 being a sprinter, maybe 15:30. But yeah, I topped out at the 3K in those days. We didn't have, there weren't road races like there are now. The cross-country season, there was a 10-mile road race. I ran 55 minutes and 55 seconds, I remember. There was a 6-mile at Toowoomba. I ran 33:30, which is probably about just under 35 for 10K. But I didn't know sort of how to run those distances, to be honest. I'm not saying I could have run much faster.
Yeah.
So just my bent. But anyway, I came to a point where my architectural studies was 3 years full time, which is when I was doing all that good running, followed by 3 years part time. That is a full time job plus part time study. And I just couldn't fit the running in. So that's when I sadly gave it away for quite some years.
Yes, almost. There you go, sorry.
Got married and started having babies.
Yeah, I was going to say, fast forward a few years, almost 40 years ago now, first child, Andrew. How was it running in those first few years? Because I do recall, I posted a photo actually up on Instagram about a week ago of us, I think it was Andrew, Lloyd and myself. For the listeners, that's the three oldest brothers in the family. I think at the Roadrunners event that we were on the weekend, we were there. And this is about, almost 30 years ago, if I'm thinking correctly.
Right. Yeah. So what I did from, that was 1980 to 1995, so we're talking, a decade and a half, I'd train up for a couple of months for these emerging fun runs that were coming through and run them. And I was sort of competent. I'd be in the first, 5% or something. Given that the wide range of participants. But as you guys got to a point where you could, run 1K, 2K, 5Ks, I sort of pushed you. I might have been a pushy father in the sports area. I never took, just for the listeners, I never took any interest in my son's academic life. I took a deep interest in their sporting life. You seem to have all worked out academically okay. But the sport for the boys, it was just a fabulous sort of guide for their whole life. It gave them wonderful, wonderful peer group friends and just a huge body of lessons, I think, for life.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah. Yeah, you found the importance of it and how that stemmed out to other parts of life, didn't you?
Yeah, I think so. And actually, I might mention City to Surf.
Ollie, yeah. What do you reckon? Yeah, the tradition.
Yeah, so... I guess we've sort of got through my running life number one, and running life number two's coming, which will be a lot simpler than the last one. But I had a marriage breakup, as you're deeply aware, Oliver, in 95, 96. And that sort of led me into my running life number two, because in those days, the separation was pretty heavily weighted in favour of the mother having the kids most of the time. It's a little bit more even-handed these days, but I did have this huge sadness and loneliness in my life. And actually, I got very sick. I'm 78 kilograms now. I'm 75 if I'm running a marathon, and I look pretty skinny and horrible. But I got down to 68 kilograms, very
Wow.
sick in 97. And yeah, it was a bit of a mess emotionally and everything. And I decided I needed something to get out of it. And I reached back into my running, actually. And I was convalescing at my mother's. And my childhood, I'm talking early childhood run, was roughly 800 meters around the block. And I tried to walk around the block, and I couldn't even walk around the block. And I thought, I've got to do something about this. So I was 30, nearly 38 by then. And I just slowly built up to a point where before turning 40, I wanted to run sub 40 for 10K, and I did. So around 39:40, a couple of months before turning 40. So, you know, I dragged myself with a lot of help from friends and family and a lot of practitioners, all sorts of practitioners, to get to a point of some health, and also including counsellors, actually. But also I got into self-help books. One book that changed my life was called Manhood, written by a guy called Steve Bidoff, and I've given a copy to some or all of you boys of this wonderful book about what it actually means to be a man. And Steve Bidoff in that book points out that in modern society we don't really have an initiation ceremony, that boys just sort of drift from childhood to manhood without, you know, the ceremony that traditional cultures had, which was really meaningful and had all sorts of benefits that he describes. And I sort of pondered this, and I thought the obvious thing for us is something to do with running. So all those years, those 15 years we mentioned, and the boys were coming along, and I remember you as probably a six-year-old, Holly, and Andrew and Lloyd a couple of years older. They had bigger bikes than you, and you had a little black bike called Little Villain. Yeah. By the way, listeners, Oliver was by far and away the naughtiest of all my kids. Still is, actually.
About to say, not now.
But yeah, Ollie would pedal like hard with a cadence of about 200, I think, trying to keep up with his brothers. But I used to go for a run. I wasn't training in any way seriously, but I'd go for a run with the little boys on their bikes. It was just absolutely, completely delightful around the Jeeps football fields and the Maris Flats and, yeah, at Dorrington Park. It was just delightful with our wonderful, wonderful border collie called Chloe.
Yeah.
Very, very happy days. So, you know, the boys were aware of this sort of running caper, and the boys would do well at their school sports. And at age 14, what are you in 14, grade 9?
Yeah, grade 9 now, yeah.
So the boys, 14's the sort of age that I chose. And I would tell the boys when they turn 7 that 7's the most important number. At 7, you're not a little boy anymore. At 14, you're starting to become a man. And at 21, you're a man. Okay, so the start of the journey to manhood is 14, and I took the boys one by one as they turned 14 down to the city to surf. For most of them, it was their first plane flight, actually. Being a big family on one income, we didn't have expensive holidays. So, yeah, first plane flight and, you know, a wonderful big city, and then this incredible event, 14K at 14. And anyone who's done the city to surf, it's sort of more like a party than a race, or a music
for most
festival.
Runners, yeah.
Yeah, except if you're up in that very front 0.1%. But, yeah, the boys seem to really respond to this as a serious symbol of, you know, life's tough, the run's tough, but you just push on. And that was the simple message about this event. And I think, what do you think, mate? You sort of look forward to it and look back on it fondly, or what's the?
I definitely think so. And it certainly helped with the massive hill in that race. That was part of the the challenge too. But I think it was, definitely an intimate experience, wasn't it? One-on-one with your dad, where in a big family of six, that's quite unique. And to have that physicality as a part of the challenge only helped, I think, for other things for sure.
Yeah, look, I think all the boys loved it, but my recollection is Oliver loved it the most, actually. He's
Any
just...
idea of times? Any idea of times that...
Look, Dylan was the fastest. And I think the rest of the boys were pretty even, except for Lloyd, who had glandular fever at the time, which was a
Yeah,
spectacular effort.
correct.
I think you were all low 70s. You know, it's not slow. 14 years old. It's a third of a marathon, 14K.
Yeah.
So it's pretty significant. And then we saw all the sights and, you know, on the Manly Ferry and all those sorts of things. It was just bloody great. So that sort of became a family tradition. And in a way, curious to see if you boys might do something similar with your
Yeah.
sons and indeed daughters, of course.
Yeah, for sure. So if I just clarify, you never run a half or a marathon in that first part of your running after school between 18 and 22, 23. It was only after all of this where you'd now started to begin to get into the halves and the fulls.
Yeah, so the cross country season in my youth, I think the longest race I did was a 10 miler. It was at the desert, actually, 55-55 I ran. I haven't worked out how good that is. It's a weird distance. Then so I've turned 40, gone sub 40, and kept improving. So, but first of all, I went to the run in with Phil Hungerford. At the time, that was just a sort of slow social group, and I needed something a bit more serious. And then I joined up with in training. This would have been in 1999 at UQ, and I'm pretty sure I took you boys along sometimes.
Possibly, yeah.
I certainly remember Dylan there, and I remember a 5K time trial with Lloyd, and he beat me actually. That's one thing of interest. I never let my boys beat me at anything, chess, badminton, running, anything. So when they beat me, they knew they earned it.
Yeah, I think I did come to one or two, but it was definitely in my more of a social phase of my life. So my running, I was a thing of the past at that point, didn't run too well from memory at those sessions. But I do have a memory of it to some degree.
Yeah. The other thing with UQ, mate, is those wonderful AIC meets on the Friday nights at the track that you boys did. God, I loved them.
Yeah.
Watching you guys belt around.
Yeah, and that's the other
You'd
thing
do
too.
everything too, wouldn't you? You'd go in the 100, 200, you'd do the lot.
Oh, I did. Didn't do well, but I did everything. That was the thing, you know, not many people or kids would participate in these things. So you just go out there and see how you go at anything. Should have thrown a javelin or something.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, there's PB that's available to me. I must take up a javelin. this is all my running life number two, which is goes from 97 when I was quite sick through to 2014 when we started work, and which I'll talk about in a sec. But in training was good for me. So at age 42, across 3 months actually, I set all my PBs for this running life number two. So it was 37:32 for 10K on the road, 37:36 for 10K on the track, 17:49 for 5K. And my first half marathon of my life, still my PB, which was 82:55 where was that? That was Gold Coast. The 10K was at Roadrunners. Can't remember the 5K. So there's this little block there. And the interesting thing is you don't know when you've run a PB that's going to, you know, be on your tombstone. Yeah. You just don't. So, so in a way, my advice to everybody is if you've been running for 5 years and improving, this is for people over 30 and improving, somewhere in that zone from 5 years after taking up running to 10 years after taking up running is going to be your PB. So if you suspect you're on PB pace in that zone, 5 to 10 years after initiating your running, go for it.
Yeah.
You know, smash yourself because you might never, ever get back there.
Yeah.
And it's just a bit of reflection. But so that was 2001. There was a lovely World Masters Athletics track meet that I participated in. I mean, anyone could go in it. You didn't have to get selected that year, that a couple of those times are from. And then I held my 10K at sub 38 for a few years after that. And I did the Noosa half marathon in 2003. I ran 1:23:10. And I was walking back from that, and the 10K race was finishing, and here was Pat Carroll, 40 years old, winning the 10K, beating the pack of 30-year-olds, 25-year-olds in about 31 or 32 or something, winning the 10K at 40. I thought, far out, you know, this guy's nearly as old as me. And he'd been a Queensland hero for a decade or more. And then soon after that, I heard that he'd started a running group. So I went along to Pat's thinking, you know, this is somebody I can learn a lot from, and I bloody did. So I was with Pat for 4 years. The first session, there was just four of us, Pat, Robbie Lofthouse, who you know, a lady called Jo Sherman I've lost touch with, but she became a very good friend at the time, and myself. And, we just went for a 10 or 12K run, and it was just Pat and me, basically. I thought I was in heaven. He's a great Pat. And, you know, old Daggy Jonesy running along beside. I thought I was very, very special. And pretty quickly, his group grew. It might have been a group of about 40 for a couple of years, and let's say 30 would turn up every session. And we were a very close bunch of mates, actually, under Pat's sort of wonderful, wonderful personality and his great knowledge of running. I've got a lifetime friend, Peter Hallahan, from that era, Mark Kenny, Tess Fabian, David Lang. It was just Jan Avery. It's just a wonderful group of people. I kept breaking 38. I hovered around 1:23 for a half and just loved all the training. And then in 2007, one of my mates from in training, Paul Worrell, who's a fellow architect, invited me on a Sunday run, and another guy there, I was very impressed by Rod Sodaro, who'd been twice Australian Ironman champion, top 20 at Kona, held the record for the Brisbane Marathon for what it's worth. Anyway, I talked to him for the whole run, which was probably 2 hours or something, and I was very impressed with his knowledge. He's got a master's in exercise physiology, was at the AIS with Pat, actually. And I thought, I think I'll give this guy a go, actually. Pat's group had changed quite a bit in its demographic. I was still happy there, and I still had my mates there, but I just wanted to try something different. So I went to Rod's group. And I didn't really improve, but I did learn a lot and drifted into triathlon. Triathlon, well, let's be honest, most runners are great, great guys, great girls, just wonderful people. Triathletes, I think if you're going to enter the land of triathlete, you've got to sort of leave your personality at the door, you know? To do well in an Olympic distance triathlon, you've got to train 15 hours a week and 20 hours a week for a half Ironman, and probably 30 for an Ironman. So you've got to be a pretty focused and probably boring person, to be honest. So, I mean, as an extreme, Rod Sodaro would swim 3.5K nonstop in his home pool of 10 meters long.
No way.
Right. And he would do a 5-hour cycle on a stationary bike in his garage with no music or anything. That's what I mean. These guys,
it's almost a schooling day.
Yeah, and most of them were single, and it's obvious why. And it did have a bad impact on my second marriage, actually, I think. But you know, I did okay in the triathlon. I was towards the front end in the swims. I was in the middle of the pack in the cycle, and I did 7 triathlons and I won every run leg, but I came off my bike pretty badly in 2012, and I didn't cycle for a long time after that.
Why do you think that you got into the triathlon as opposed to really pushing the running though?
I actually am a bit of a social creature, and I do suffer from following peer group pressure. So Rod was in partnership with Brad Bevan, multiple world triathlon championship. So the group was called Croc Squad. Brad Bevan's the Croc. And yeah, they're basically all triathletes. So they talked me into getting on a bike, and I was a decent swimmer, so I had a crack. And I enjoyed it. I don't know that I'll ever go back there. Yeah, it was a bit of fun. And so Rod left. He went to Melbourne at the end of 2013, and there's quite a few of us floundering about what to do. So I said, listen, guys, I'm happy to act as coach, and we can start again. And the reaction was, well, what do you bloody know, Jonesy? And I said, well, I've been around running a long time. I think I know a fair bit. And I could sense that they wanted someone with a bit more knowledge. So I dragged Oliver into the enterprise, and we started West End Running Group at the beginning of 2014, Oliver and me. And
yeah.
It was a wonderful adventure, wasn't it, mate? So for 2014, I think my recollection is you did all the warm-ups. I did the Tuesday sessions. You did the Thursday sessions.
Yeah, correct.
We charged $5, which just went straight to charity. That was
it
the
did,
concept.
Yeah.
And then at the end of 2014, we thought it's probably time to make this a proper business. I didn't really want to be in another business beyond my work, so it became Oliver and Claire's business, WERG.
And you moved away.
So I was there another few months and went to Oxford. So that was the end of my running life number two.
Yeah, 10 years ago. That's crazy.
Oliver and Claire just built up a very highly spirited, positive, wonderful group of people, didn't you? It was just bloody great. So I'd join in when I visited back from England. You did a fantastic job on that. Didn't make you a lot of money or anything.
No, but to be a part of it and giving back to the sport was great. And Claire will love that you mentioned her name in there. She was a great influence on getting this is my wife, by the way, for the listeners, getting the women in there, her youthful nature and friendly nature, and her marketing experience too. So she'd do all the Instagramming and things like that and digital stuff for me, which was fantastic.
Yeah, and my Claire came along too. Just incidentally, Oliver and I both married a girl called Claire Louise.
Claire Jones, two of them.
It was a good, actually it was probably 50% female. It was there's quite a few old guys, a few youngies, a couple occasionally were faster than you, Ollie, but not many. Mind you kept improving through that period, of course.
Yeah, it always sort of can hold any runner back who's coaching, I guess, in some capacity. So I always thought it almost a good thing. It kind of lengthened my running life, so to speak, I think, because I wasn't ever running 100%, had to sort of encourage people along the way, but running with them is something that some coaches do and some don't, but I was certainly running almost all the sessions I could, hey?
No, it was just fabulous. So look, running life number three for me was Oxford. So I'd done a master's in management and a master's in business in Australia, and on the strength of that and my working life, I got into a course at Oxford Uni, 2-year master's, and then I enjoyed that so much, I went on to a PhD at UCL. So it gave me 5 years living in Oxford, and my studies were sort of a hobby, to be honest. And I got off the bus at, it's called Gloucester Green, the bus terminus in Oxford, and right there was a running shop. I thought, oh, this is pretty good. So with my suitcase and completely jet lagged, I went into the running shop and said, can you recommend a running group? And they said, oh, Headington Road Runners. And so I had sort of a 15-hour sleep on it, whatever, and then contacted the membership secretary. Name's Marianne Fisher. Can I join up? Yep, you're in. And went to a long run on the Sunday, led by a guy called Graham Day, and then another one by a guy called Mike Davis. And yeah, I was in, and extremely welcoming group. And their annual race, because the clubs, it's a whole different system over there, which I'll explain briefly, but the clubs each hold an event each year, and Headington holds a 5-mile race, which was 2 weeks after I landed. So I went in this race, it was 5 miles, 8.05K, which I ran in basically 4 minute K pace, and came about, I thought, oh, it's only 300 or 400 people in this. I could bloody win my age group. I came ninth in my age group with 4 minute Ks at 56 years old, you know, and
it's crazy.
What the hell's going on here? So England's very, very strong in running. It's a huge part of the culture. There's a wonderful website called Run Britain, and you can do a filtered search, the region and the distance and the road or trail, hilly or flat, and find dozens of races across England every weekend. And it's just a runner's heaven.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? Especially with the pub culture and, you know, the lack of light in winter and things like that. The weather for some.
The interesting, funny you mentioned pubs, because the cross-country season, there's a cross-country every week, and they run, I mean, these are real cross-countries through mud and up hills and sliding down very muddy hillsides, and it's really crazy stuff. The pummies are all crazy. And it's always off to the pub afterwards. So the races start at 10, which is it took a lot of adapting to, but yeah, they off to the pub.
Pub
so
lunch.
Yeah, it was bloody great. And a lot of these races, they're that sort of size, 400 participants, and they'll start and finish at a local rugby club or cricket club or something. And the running club will put on cakes. So you finish the race and there's this huge spread of cakes, you know, and for £2, you get a piece of cake half the size of a house brick. and in fact, at some races, the local beer company's the sponsor and there's beer on tap at the finish line too. It's a whole different culture. But this was a wonderful running club of 400 people, and I got in with a group. There's probably 20 of us that range from 38 to 41 minute 10K runners. And yeah, we would just belt along in our interval sessions at 4 minute Ks or whatever as a group like that. So running in a train like that. There's this wonderful road called Marston Ferry Road that's a bit like Sir William McGregor Drive at UQ, and we'd just belt along this road at these paces. No one would be game to drop off the back, you know. I got very fit. And the other thing that happened for me was I got injured in 2015. I've got a fabulous physio at QSMC called Shane Lemke.
Oh, yeah.
Been going to for 25 years.
This was the calf, wasn't it? Achilles calf?
You've got Chris Brady there, haven't you?
Yeah. Shout out to QSMC.
That's a great clinic. And he said, look, if you don't take up gym work, you'll keep getting this injury and probably a lot of other injuries. And I've done plenty of reading about it. And the lesson is that you know, from 40 maybe, but definitely from 50, you need a good gym load to keep running at your best and to avoid injury. So at age 55, I took up gym work three times a week. And what happened, sort of an accidental experiment, from age 55 to 60, when the textbooks say your times will drop 5%. And the only thing I changed was doing gym work. My times from age 55 for 5K, 5 miles, 10K and half marathon improved 1%, right? So through all these years at Oxford, age 55 to 60, I was moving up and up and up and up in the field. And when I turned 60, suddenly, humility aside, I was winning everything I went in. So I won the Edinburgh half marathon in 1:27:50. I won the main 10K fun run in Oxford, about 10,000 participants. I'm talking over 60s, obviously, in 39:37. And that was an age grade of 84%. And I won a lot of these little races that I mentioned. So it was extremely satisfying. It was just, at the climate helps too. So it's cold. So it's good. You know, good for running, but it was a very, very pleasurable period. And this gang of guys, I'll do a quick shout out, mate.
Yeah,
Sid and Khan, a couple of brothers, very good mates, Chris, Carl, Doug, Marcus, Kevin, John, yeah, a lot of guys, Rachel and Kate. It was just a very, very happy period for me and for Claire, actually. So Claire's, and my wife's a national level swimmer from New Zealand in her youth, and she took up running because swimming's not really accessible in England. So we had a wonderful time and made some very good friends, and I had some wonderful running experiences in some beautiful parts of the country, actually.
Yeah, remember your Strava following just like doubled in the amount of people on there, and all the commenting from those abroad in the UK who I had no idea who they were, but it was obvious that you had an impact over there and got to meet some pretty special people.
The other thing I wouldn't mind mentioning, Ollie, is I don't consider myself a marathoner, but I've done 5 marathons, and at age 60, I did Amsterdam Marathon in 3:09:14 and came fourth. I don't know how many were in my age group, but, you know, some hundreds. So I got very, very fit. And I think that 5 years, I had one minor injury, but I think that the gym work protected my body.
Oh, definitely.
And I was like, just build up. You know, wonderful running environment with a lot of great colleagues to get to a point where I could do those sort of performances. Look, I've got a controversial view on marathons, and that is that they're bad for you and no one should do one.
I reckon this is why I have never done one, subconsciously. That's in the back of my head. I do know that.
I'm being flippant, but I think a lot of people who are not suited to marathons do them. And I have to again say that I've only done a marathon due to peer group pressure. I just love a 10K, I love a half marathon. And it's not just the marathon itself, it's the amount of training. It's huge wear and tear on your body.
It's a loading.
Particularly when you're over 50. So I was very resistant. I did my first marathon as a present to myself for my 50th in Japan.
What a nice present.
Yeah, well, I was aiming at 3:05 and I ran 3:25, so you can imagine the pain involved there. And then the next year I did Gold Coast aiming at 3 and did 3:11, just as painful. So sort of finished in tears, I'm never doing this again. And then, Rod Sodaro guided me very expertly to 2:59:13 at Melbourne in 2012. I was joyful about that. So I do understand the enormous satisfaction of doing a marathon and doing it to the best of your ability. So I've got, despite what I was saying earlier, I've got great respect for people doing marathons to the best of their ability, which involves, you know, at least 3 months dedicated training on top of a previous 9 months of, you know, injury-free fitness, in my view. And then I went to Chicago in 2013. Rod felt I was in shape for something pretty damn good, but my knee went 3 weeks before, so I was a spectator. But that's all right. It wasn't my primary passion. And then what was my fourth? I did Berlin in the year that Kipchoge set his first world record. 2018 in 3:13 as a 59-year-old. And as I said, my last one forever was Amsterdam in 2019, 3:09:14. And I ran, I forget the kilometre pace, something close to 4:30. I just ran that the whole way with very little variance. It was a beautifully judged piece of pacing by me based on many months of marathon pace. Surges in long runs and a lot of threshold work. Look, the only other thing I want to mention about my running life number 3 in England was the coach at Headington, Evelyn, encouraged me to do a coaching course, which I did, and it was just fabulous. It's called Coach in Running Fitness, and I came back to Australia, and Australian Athletics gave me a level 2 coaching certificate as an equivalence. I did know a lot of stuff that they taught just from being decades and decades in the game, but it was very satisfying sort of formalising that. And Headington gave me a Thursday night threshold session to run for, I don't know how long it went for, a year maybe, and that was a lot of fun. Yeah, but we came back to Australia in February 21, and I immediately joined Watts, and I immediately got injured because I was basically straight off the plane doing a speed session and I had my sacroiliac joint and I was out for quite a while.
Yeah, and there's some fast runners there too.
Yeah. What were we going to talk about? You mentioned as we closed off just a moment ago, or can I just bash on?
You probably can, just covering those five marathons, and you've spoken about those locations. Any other experiences there that you have fond memories of? In any of those international marathons?
Yeah, look, Berlin's probably the best organised race I've ever run in. You know, in the big races, there's no room to warm up. Berlin's got this space down the side of the pens where you can do run-throughs or whatever. So it's a big advantage. And the behaviour of the people at that marathon is pretty extraordinary in terms of their urinating. There's just shrubs all along the side, and men and women just relieve themselves. It's pretty interesting and bonding. But I mean, that's an extraordinary event. I'm so glad I've done that. That's my only major. I imagine the other majors. Well, I was at Chicago. That looked equal in how it's put together and the excitement. But those expos at the big thing, I mean, the Gold Coast Marathon Expo is great, but the expos at those majors are something else, well worth in themselves. But yeah, that sort of wrapped up running life number three. March 21, I injured my sacroiliac joint. Took a fair while to sort that out with some injections, but that's all been fine ever since the injections. Later in 21, I developed this pain in to the right of my spine, my sort of upper middle back, and osteo couldn't fix it. Suggested I go to a GP. This was sort of getting to December 21. GP tried a few things, didn't get fixed, and sent me off to a thoracic surgeon, and he tried a few things, sort of drifting now into March 22. And then he uttered the question, have you ever been exposed to asbestos? And my heart sank, actually, because I've been exposed to a lot of asbestos.
Yeah, straight away.
Partly helping my father at home on the house, but partly as an architecture student in the 70s, spending a lot of time on sites and remembering the dust without any protection. So, yes, I started spending a lot of time on sites in 80 and 81, and asbestos was banned in 82. So just a bit of an unfortunate overlap. So he sent me for a biopsy, and I was diagnosed with mesothelioma, which is an incurable and terminal lung cancer. And that was that. So I was told that the median survival is 19 months from diagnosis. Now, what's today? Tuesday. On Thursday this week, it's exactly two years since the diagnosis. And he said that 10% of people live for 5 years or more. And I decided, well, you know, I'm pretty fit and I'll probably be one of them. And that's the number that I told my family and friends at the time. So I went on a course of chemotherapy, a sort of 7-hour transfusion every 3 weeks, and that leaves you very, very sick for a week or so, another week getting better, and then a week of being fine, and then round you go again. So what I did, immediately before the chemo, I just went down to the 1-meter work track at Riverside Drive, previously 1 meter, sorry, 1 kilometer Pat Carroll track. And I just belted out 5 1Ks, 2 minutes rest in 3:55, just as a marker. So if things went badly, you know, that's where I got to.
PB session.
Age 63. Yeah, that was just a marker in the ground. So through that 6 times 3 weeks of chemo and it's hard to describe how horrible it is, but I would start my running in the second week as best I could. The first week I was sort of bedridden for a couple of days and could barely walk for the rest. But by the third week I could run. So I just ran as hard as I could in the third week. And that got sort of worse and worse with each of the six sessions. And then straight after I finished the sixth one, I got COVID fairly badly, and then got through that. And yeah, I was a bit of a mess physically by then. And obviously the way out of that mess was exercise. And I got back to Watts. And Watts have been a wonderful support to me, a lot of good friends there. Shiloh and Brenno have been great, very, you know, caring. And the other thing that came out of it was I was extremely physically weak at the end of the chemo. So it was very frightening, actually, as a man to feel physically weak. It's just not where you want to be. And plus, you know, a lot of reading over the years about the need for gym work as you age. Well, I was sort of in an extreme situation. And I signed up a PT one-on-one twice a week at a little gym called West End Strength. Dan's the guy's name, and he's just fabulous. And he's been working with me, and I'm getting quite strong. I've got a sense that I might be as strong as I was in my 40s, you know, and this is 2 years or a year and a half after joining Dan. And it's protecting me from injury with my running. So I'm being careful with the running. And this is my running life number four I'm in now. I'm running three times a week, and I'm running as hard as I can, basically three times a week. I know the 80-20 theory. I don't want to do that. I've decided I'm just going to run as hard as I can three times a week, and my 80 of the 20 is going to be other exercise. So I swim, yoga once a week, cycle once a week, and gym twice a week. That's my 80, and my 20 of hard work is my three runs, all with Watts. And it's just fabulous being in that group of people. And I'm, you know, to have gone through the emotional experience of that diagnosis and the chemo and so on, and to be participating fully, you know, a fair bit slower than I was 4 years ago, but participating fully with a great group of people, that's really all I can ask for.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And did you sort of arrive to that that group and tell Shiloh, the coach, immediately about their diagnosis, or is something that came up later in the piece?
No, when I was diagnosed, I let the family and friends know, and I let Shiloh know. And through her, I drafted an email for her to send to the whole group, which she very generously did. And the thing that I'd say, and a lot of people have experienced cancer in their family, what the cancer sufferer wants more than anything is just to be treated normally, actually. You're not the disease, you know, you're still the same person. So I've had that experience at work, and I've had that experience in the running group. The family experience has been interesting, Ollie, because suddenly, you know, the relationships changed within the family, really. We all sort of realised how much we value each other, actually. So that's been, you know, there's been a lot more silver lining out of this than cloud, put it that way. I'm very grateful for, you know, what's come from it. And I'm on an experimental drug, so I still get a treatment every 4 weeks. And what happened with the chemo is after 2 out of 6 sessions, my tumour shrunk from 25 millimetres to 3 millimetres. And after 4 sessions, it disappeared and hasn't come back. It will come back, but it hasn't come back, and it's thanks to two things. One's the experimental drug, but the other is how fit I am. So I've been telling people, you know, everybody, something's coming to get you one day. You might be 55, you might be 85, something's coming to get you, and the fitter and stronger you are when that happens, the better chance you have of having a reasonable, healthy, you know, life for much longer than otherwise.
Yeah, I was going to say that. And also, I think mentally, the toughness that running can give you in training and sessions in whatever. I'm sure that's had an impact positively on getting through this at the moment.
That's right, mate. So you think about, you think about, set of six 1Ks, say, by the third K, you're pretty tired and you push hard in the fourth one and you're completely smashed and you're back up for the fifth somehow and you just drag yourself to the end of that fifth K. And if you think about the sixth K during the fourth and the fifth, you're buggered. You've got to think about where you're at. And then you somehow pick the sixth one because you're close to the end, you can get there. And that's probably my tip for a race too, actually. My strategy for a 10K, because I was finding the 6K to the 8K really mentally so difficult. My strategy for the 10K these days is it's an 8K race. So I just go as hard as I can to an 8K point and don't even think about the last 2K. Survival. And somehow it takes care of it. You've invested so much, you don't want to waste it,
Yeah.
And
yeah,
no greater joy than running that last K, say sub 40, running that last K, knowing that you're going to achieve your goal, but you can't back off 0.5% or you won't get it. But you know you can do it, but it's hurting like hell.
Yeah, I agree. My theory is you can get to that point and know that you can give it 100% to finish with, because it should mean a lot to you. So I certainly agree with it not mattering that much if you're focusing on running hard to a certain point like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can apply that to a lot.
I've
certainly applied my learnings from running in my business life. And a big part of it is just that coming back, training, time and again, practice. And you get the rewards. And that applies to business. It applies to commitment to your family. It applies to so much in your life. And I'm sure you can learn that from a lot of sports, but the difference with running, I think, is that sort of pain tolerance that can be reinterpreted as emotional pain or mental pain. If you know that you can run a bit damn hard 10K, which personally I think is harder than a marathon, but if you know you can run a hard 10K or if you know you can run a marathon, that sort of sets you up pretty damn well in the rest of your life.
And do you think that the routine of running too has helped through life in general, in addition to those things that you mentioned?
Yeah, so I did have those wilderness years between running life one as a teenager and running life two starting in my mid-30s. And yes, there was certainly something missing for me in those days. But yeah, it is that habit, isn't it? You just need to hold that habit. And of course, there's times when you can't do it for family reasons or health or maybe weather in some environments. But that commitment to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it, yeah, that keeps you going.
Yeah, for sure. Addison's getting a little bit wild, but we'll trek ahead. I want to talk quickly about footwear, because I just want you to get in the mind space of hypothetically pretending you're back in your absolute prime, as in like if you were to be training and running hard at about the age of 25 to 30, if not a little bit older, and you had the super shoes on, and we're talking about 5-10K events and that half and marathon, what sort of times do you think you'd be running if that was the case?
Yeah, it's the old I could have thing, which doesn't really carry any weight, but I'll answer your question because it's fun. So I think when I did my 8:49 3K at age 19, what was missing for me in those years, which is well known now, is gym work. I think, Percy Cerity and Herb Elliott knew that in the 50s and 60s, and it sort of got a bit forgotten. I think if I'd been at AIS or a uni, an American uni or Cambridge or something, and done that sort of training and had super shoes, yeah. So I think 15-10 equivalents for my 3K, I'd say I could have got to low 14s actually. with another, you know, five, six, 7 years of with modern coaching knowledge and modern technology. Yeah.
And the thing too with footwear is not just the one-off race, but they talk about the impact over years, you know, training in these shoes, not just for sessions, but even the volume shoes, which are far more cushioned and thicker, and that ability to recover better, to be better the next day and better in the next session as well. Surely that would have had an impact on runners back in the day.
Well, you listen to a YouTube interview with Derek Clayton, who was the first man under 210 for a marathon, which he did twice. The shoes he ran in and the volumes of training he did, I can't imagine what he could have done with you know, some guidance on reasonable limits for volume A and B, the shoes, because he was in literally in Dunlop Volleys.
That's crazy.
You know, running 400 Ks some weeks. Unbelievable.
Yeah, the thing I guess you miss, though, is the strength benefit of a minimalist shoe. You think it's still a benefit of running even barefoot on grass or running in shoes every now and then to strengthen the calves and the legs?
Look, we did do that in the 70s. We'd have a barefoot session on the grass track sometimes. I just think the impact on your joints is a bigger disadvantage than any advantage that you can come up with. And that the cushioning is really important. I really do. It sort of feels fun and interesting at the time, but no, I can't imagine it's good for wear.
Yeah, well, the other thing I wanted to ask you about quickly before we get to some listener questions, actually, was the marathon itself. Because we've only had in the last couple of years some Australian runners go under 2 hours 10, for example. Brett Robinson's one example, and Pat Tiernan, you may know about. But it took years for these times to drop, almost 20 years between records. Liam Adams is the other one, isn't he? That has lowered those times. Mm. What do you think that comes down to in terms of the coaching and the athlete, and how that they've somehow found something in there to now reduce the times to as quickly as those times?
Yeah, I don't know, except to say that that Rob DiCostella, Steve Monaghetti, Pat Carroll era, those guys really pushed each other. You get that, you know, Stewie McSwain and Ollie Hoare sort of, and the other guys, you get these clusters that really push each other forward. Co-Ovette, Cram in England, those sort of clusters of people happening at the same time. It might be that those guys in the through the 80s, Monaghetti, Carroll, DiCostella, wouldn't have done as well if it wasn't for each other, you know. And maybe that cluster didn't happen between them and Adams and Tiernan and Robinson. But, yeah, it's an interesting question. Maybe athletics as a sport gets strong and weak. Our family's rugby fanatics. We've noticed rugby get strong and weak and strong and weak in the decades we followed it. Could be the same with our sport, Ollie.
There could be a number of things. Hills. The other thing is runners potentially running too much on the flat or trying to run really fast sessions that give them confidence, at least, or other people confidence that they can run fast because they found a nice slab of concrete or dirt that's dead flat and they run a fast session. But how about that honest hard work up hills as well?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I spent a lot of time over here talking to Pat Carroll, and his training in Canberra was mainly off-road and a lot of hills around Canberra. So I'm not sure that happens a lot with Brisbane runners, for example. We tend to hug the river, or in your case, you know, the flats out beyond Nudgee.
Yep.
It's funny because it's a very hilly city, and my training in my youth, those 5 miles every morning, we lived in a house that was sort of the lowest point. So whether I headed north, south, east or west, I had to run up a massive friggin' hill, you know. So I just sort of accidentally probably got quite hill strong because I lived in a hilly suburb and couldn't drive at age 13 somewhere else, of course. But yeah, the inner city tracks around the river are pretty crowded, aren't they, with running groups?
Yeah, I think it's easy to run the flat, isn't it, and think that you can sort of save the body for those faster sessions. But That definitely is a good thing, I think, if you naturally live in a hilly area, even on an easy run or easy days where you're just sort of jogging over the hills can have a benefit for runners out there.
The other dimension now, of course, is Strava. So I'd sort of probably subconsciously or even consciously avoid hills. So my Strava kilometre average is better than it otherwise would to my mates. That's a, you know, very open confession, exposing my soul. But Strava probably hasn't been a great influence in some ways. We all love it. We all love it. But it does make you sort of train as if you've got 200 people watching you.
Yeah, like you do, 200 about, isn't it? Hey, let's get to these listener questions. So what I do usually is put this on Instagram and get a few people jump on and ask questions. Strangely enough, two questions are exactly the same. And one of them is your son, my younger brother, Reese. And he's asked the same question as Brooke Williams. She's another co-host with me on the podcast. And literally word for word, the same question. That is, what is your favorite running memory of all time?
Yeah. Look, I do love racing, but I even more, and Rod Sodaro called me a great trainer. My training's always been a bit better than my racing. I just love threshold sessions. And there were threshold sessions in Oxford with all those guys. In cold weather, sort of misty, if I just sort of felt like I was running in heaven, you know, maybe four times 1.5K or something. That it's hard to beat that. And there's some beautiful relays actually in England, one through the South Downs, one around Norfolk, one that's across a ridge called Ridgeway. They were wonderful. Look, in a way, going well under 40 minutes at age 60, which I did twice, and I just let out a shout of joy at both those finishes. that might be my favourite running memory, actually. And it might be hard to believe that that's better than winning a state championship in my youth, but that's sort of rare, you know, rarefied air in a way. In my mind, it's no big deal in national terms or anything, but for me personally, that was very special.
Okay, next one's Duncan. Duncan was a West End Running Group
runner. Hello, Duncan. Hi, Duncan.
Yeah, and he's asked you, well, the same question, but also your favorite running shoe of all time. And you've been in Super Shoes and other shoes of late too. I know you've been a Mizuno man over the years.
I'll give two answers to that. One is so the flat shoes that I talked about running through the 70s, around 79, Nike came to Australia, and I had a pair of shoes in 79 called Nike Elite, and that's what I ran that 10-mile race in, a very soft and straight. And that feeling of running in cushioned shoes, when you've never run in cushioned shoes before, was phenomenal. And I adored those shoes and actually kept them for probably 10 years after I used them. These days, on advice from Nathan Eady at QSMC, podiatrist, I use Mizuno Wave Riders that suit my foot. And I've tried Nike Zoom. And he told me that he's made a lot of money out of Nike Zoom because people bugger their feet from and I have run in the Alpha Flies, and they're spectacular, of course. So yeah, I suppose the Alpha Flies and those shoes from 40 years ago would be my two favorites, but they're not the Mizuno Wave Riders have kept me vertical for a decade or more.
Yeah, great.
I've had 30 years.
Yeah, I'm going back to Brooke actually, because her question was the same as Reese's, but and again, she's one of the co-hosts on our other show, but and I think this is a very pertinent question which we haven't covered, Dad, and that's, what age did I start to beat you as a runner?
That's interesting. I remember I'm not a park run guy, I've only done about 12, but my first park run was at New Farm with you, and I beat you. I was 1907 and you were probably 1940 or something. And then a year later, that result reversed. So that was 2013. So that's when we swapped places. And I remember you saying to me it felt weird beating that.
Yeah, I was coming out of that socializing phase as well.
Well, see, it's a shame in a way you and I didn't overlap more, because you were on the grog when I was at my peak, and I was sort of getting older as you improved very rapidly from about 2013 to now, actually. But yeah, that was when we swapped places. And then I texted you from England saying, because you'd never done a half marathon, I texted you from England saying, I reckon I could beat you over a half marathon, Ollie.
This is Brisbane Marathon now.
You raised the challenge, and we did the Brisbane half. Pretty yucky event, to be honest. But you probably won't tell me the truth about how hard you were trying, but we ran together, and I remember belting along at 4 minute Ks from about 10K onwards, trying to drop you. This was 2016, I think. 2017, maybe.
2016, I think.
Yeah. And then at 19K, you just eased past me looking like you weren't even trying.
You know, the funny thing was too, I think that point that I started to get ahead of you was where, just about where you live now on Riverside Drive. Yeah. That's where it finishes. Was running 100%.
You were behind me for quite a while, and I'm talking 1 meter behind me. And then we got to under the railway bridge, under the William Jolly Bridge, where the homeless people often are there. You dropped me there. And within 200 metres, you were 30 metres ahead of me or something.
Yeah.
With 1.5K to go.
No, I love that moment. That was a typical example of probably both you and I getting into that real zone where we can, and I think you've taught me as well to really push myself in the running in those last 2K. I think we'd run about an hour 27-ish.
Yeah, it was 127 low for me. I think maybe 126 high for you.
Yeah, and that kicked off my love for half marathon.
That was a lot of fun. I ran very hard that day. I really wanted to beat you. And it's a funny feeling as a parent racing your son, because I'm sort of cheering you, hoping you'll do well, and wanting to beat you. But that's the other thing I'll say about runners, actually, is that we're all very happy for each other to do well. So I would rather run a good time myself and have one of my rivals beat me, you know, one of my club mates beat me, than run, you know, modestly and beat that rival. You know what I mean? Mm. We're all very happy for each other to do well. It's just such a delightful community, the running community. And I don't know that happens in other individual sports.
I think we understand the individual nature of it. The fact that you've got to get out there at crazy hours in the morning and have that intrinsic motivation, whether you're in a group or not. It takes something to get up every morning and go for a run. Even if you found a good routine now, it is always a part of it, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a wonderful community to be in. And it's really, you know, running's really given me a great life from that moment. In the second lap of my 800 when I was 12 at Everton Park State School, from that moment, for the rest of my life, it's really been such a positive part of my whole existence, you know.
Oh, well, there you go. Probably a good note to finish on as my baby starts to potentially wake up. But there she goes. She got a cough. Yeah, thanks for your time, Dad. Obviously a very knowledgeable man, which has transferred into the working space, as well as your knowledge of running, and that, you know, to the time in your head that you can recall these times that you ran back in high school and things like that, and the impact it's had on your life. So a bit of a legacy here to leave behind, an audio recording of us talking for almost 2 hours now. And as we edit that, hopefully that can resonate with the listeners out there in certain ways.
Thanks so much, Ollie. It's very generous of you to include me amongst all those wonderful runners you've interviewed. So thank you.
Well, I knew you were an avid listener, so we had to get you on here at some point.
Yeah. Okay, buddy. See you soon.
Cheers. If you enjoyed listening to this episode or the Local Legend in Running podcast in general, please jump on Spotify, give it a rating. I'd much appreciate it. Thank you.